Hey there, podcast listeners. This is Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast. This week I figured we'd talk about meningitis. I had a really sick patient a week ago. This gentleman came in. He was maybe 21 years old, and he had had a seizure in the field. And when he got to us, he was just not acting right. He knew his name, but not where he was. And he was just kind of loopy. He was just moving his arms around in space. It was very strange. So we got his finger stick. It was normal. Initially, we could have just attributed this to the postictal state, but his temp came back at 102.9 Fahrenheit. And at that point, we did not think this was just residual temperature from the seizure. He had seized about 35 minutes ago. He did not have any neck stiffness. He couldn't tell us whether he had a headache or not. But at this point, we were going down a suspected central nervous system infection pathway. So that brings up the first question, which is, who do you have to suspect has meningitis or meningoencephalitis? And Van de Beek put out a study that showed four signs affect your pretest probability of meningitis. There's headache, fever, neck stiffness, and alterations of mental status. If you had none of those, your chances of having meningitis were almost nil. As you gain each one of those four, your chances go up. Now, that's pretty powerful stuff, because it means if you have none of them, you really could just stop your workup. If you have one, their chances are pretty low of having meningitis, and I'll put the paper and these numbers in the show notes. Once you start having two, you should start suspecting it, and if you have three or four, you should highly suspect it. Now, there's other things that could help. You know, if the patient had a recent sinus infection and now they have a headache and a fever, okay, that's a little, that points towards meningitis. If they have the skin findings of meningococcal disease, well, then that should be a little worrisome. Our gentleman actually did have a rash. It did not look like purpura. It was more of a maculopapular rash, but that was a little more worrisome, a little annoying that now we have a guy with fever, altered mental status, and a rash. So he got put in a droplet isolation. And the next question is, do you treat these guys with antibiotics before the results of your CSF? In my mind, the answer is absolutely yes, you do. Because it is just not a situation you want to be in when you get a positive tap and look back at the time of triage and realize the patient's been in the department 5 hours and they haven't gotten antibiotics. There's no clear standard on a time from door to antibiotics in meningitis, but our society says they should be given emergently. The IDSA says emergently. Court cases have said less than 2 hours. I don't know if that number's realistic or not in some patients, but I think what you should do is get them in as soon as possible. I think that's a fair standard. And if you suspect meningitis, I say you just give the antibiotics. Now, here's where it becomes kind of interesting, because what antibiotics do you give? You get that guy, he comes in, yeah, he has a slight headache and he has a temp of 100.6 and he says, yeah, his neck hurts a little bit, but you're looking at him, you're like, I don't think this guy has bacterial meningitis. Does he really need 3 to 4 antibiotics and antivirals? Of course not. You just want to show due diligence. So I say, if you have a suspected meningitis before the CSF, in a low to moderate pretest probability, you just give 2 grams of ceftriaxone. Get 2 sets of blood cultures first. Sometimes that's going to give you the answer while the CSF won't. You don't have to send them in these low or moderate pretest probability patients. Just draw them. You draw the blood cultures, you hold them, and you give 2 grams of ceftriaxone. You don't give the vanco. You don't give the steroids. You don't give ampicillin until you get your CSF back. So all you're really wasting is 2 grams of ceftriaxone. Most of the patients you're working up probably will be treated with antibiotics anyway. So that's the way I play it. Low, moderate pretest probability, 2 grams of ceftriaxone after drawing and holding cultures. Now, on your high pretest probability patients, I will give them all possible coverage even before I do my LP. Is there any patient you could get away with not giving antibiotics before the LP? In my mind, there's only one patient, and that's the patient you are going to elect to perform your LP, your lumbar puncture, prior to a CT scan or without getting a CT scan at any point. And in that case, you could do the LP right away and, based on your initial LP findings, could decide on antibiotics. Now, who is it safe to do this LP without CT? Well, you got to be really meticulous. They have to have a perfect mental status. They have to have no neurodeficits. They have to have no cognitive slowing or memory problems, because those patients who have those, even mild cognitive slowing or memory problems, could easily have a brain abscess, and that's probably not the best patient to tap before your CT. They can't be immunocompromised. Then the last one on the list is no papal edema. Now, I don't know about you, but at my shop, my residents generally are not so great at fundoscopic exam. It's kind of a dying skill. If you have a panoptic, it becomes a little easier, but even then, it's variable. What I say is forget about the papal edema exam and just perform an ocular ultrasound of the optic nerve sheath. And that's probably a much better indicator of increased intracranial pressure than papal edema will ever be. It responds more quickly to changes in the ICP, and I think it's been validated more frequently. I mean, there's at least 4 that I can remember articles in the literature validating ocular nerve sheath ultrasound for ICP. We'll talk about that in another podcast, how to do it. You can go to the mcrit.org site and check out my ultrasound section for some tips on that. All right, but in most of your patients, they're getting a CT first, which is why I say get the antibiotic coverage on. So you get your CT, and the only purpose of the CT is to look for signs of intracranial pressure or a big mass lesion. And I'll tell you, my personal opinion is that this whole LP-causing herniation is absolute crap. I think it's just coincident they performed the LP around the time the patient was going to herniate and then got sued as a result. But just, at least in the States, due to our medical legal climate, you probably want to get a CT first. Now, we wanted to take our patient to CT. On him, we had a high pretest probability. By this point, he's quite obtunded. So we gave him, well, let's talk about what we gave him, because I think it'll bring us to the discussion of what antibiotics do you give in a patient with suspected meningitis or meningoencephalitis. So almost every patient is going to get ceftriaxone, and that covers you for a majority of the bugs you care about, like strep pneumo, like H. influenza, like Neisseria meningitis. So the general adult dose is 2 grams. As you know by now, I do not discuss children, so you got to look it up for your kids' dosing. Oh, what about your panallergic patients? They get ceftriaxone. It's easy. Third-generation cephalosporins have almost no cross-reactivity with penicillin-allergic patients, and if they do, those panallergic patients are just as likely to be allergic to any other antibiotics you chose. It's not that the penicillin's reacting with the cephalosporins. Those articles are found at the mcrit.org site. If a patient has a cephalosporin allergy, then sure, we'll look for alternatives to ceftriaxone. But a pen allergy doesn't do it for me. So pretty much everyone, 2 grams of ceftriaxone. And like I said, if the CSF tap turns out positive, then you're going to add on a lot more. Or in your high pretest probability patient, you're going to start with more. And what is the more? Well, you add on vancomycin to cover for resistant strep pneumo. And it will also cover for that incredibly rare case of community Staph aureus meningitis. I have not seen one of those in my practice. Much more common in patients who have been hospitalized or had neurosurgical procedures. So the real reason we're giving the vanco is for strep pneumo. If the patient is young or old, they have to get coverage for listeria. So in our adult population, that means if you're over 60 years old, they get ampicillin as well. So now we're talking ceftriaxone, vancomycin, ampicillin. Now, herpes encephalitis is a deadly condition. And sure, you can pretend that you're going to base it on your red cell count and your CSF. I don't think that's accurate enough. I think you're waiting too long to get that. In some centers, sometimes our cell count results won't come back for 2 hours. So what I would say is if the patient has any neurologic signs, if they're obtunded, if they have focal neurologic deficits, if they have seized, then you just cover them for the encephalitides, and the only one you really have a treatment for is the herpes encephalitis, and so you give the acyclovir. So in a sick patient, I will be giving ceftriaxone, vanco, and acyclovir. If they are old, I will add on ampicillin. If they're a patient with immunocompromise and you suspect tuberculosis, you could consider adding on rifampin. If you have some reason to suspect a fungal source, then you start talking like amphotericin. I generally will get ID involved in those cases. Amphotericin is a hideous drug. So I am not empirically covering those unless I have something to go along with it. And we'll talk about that in just a sec. If the patient's recently been hospitalized or has had a neurosurgical procedure recently, you can consider covering for pseudomonal meningitis. And that just means you change your ceftriaxone probably to something like cefepime or imipenem. So we're getting ready to take our patient to CT. He kept moving around on the stretcher, flailing about. And I'll tell you, this brings up one of the primary premises of emergency critical care, which is the ED intensivist or the ED resuscitationist. And all those folks listening to my show, I consider you all to be ED resuscitationists, takes control of the situation. That's the beauty of intensive care in the ED, is that you have the means at your disposal to take a chaotic situation and bring it to a nice controlled state. And the way you control a patient who needs an emergent CT, but they're obtunded and they're not allowing it to happen, is to take control of their airway, get the patient sedated, and get the CT. Now you can mess around with sedating agents like Haldol, droperidol, benzodiazepines, and leave the patient unintubated. I think generally that's a mistake in the critically ill patient. On this patient, we elected to intubate him at this point. His mental status had been declining since his arrival. So we did a neuroprotective intubation in case he did have increased ICP. We maintained oxygenation and his blood pressure. We got him intubated and we took him over to CAT scan. And the CT was pretty much negative, maybe some signs of sinusitis. At that point, we brought him back to the department to perform a lumbopuncture. So you're performing an LP in a suspected meningitis patient. The first deal is that their positioning is lateral recumbent. You should not be doing seated LPs, because if you do seated LPs, you're not getting opening pressure. And in my mind, opening pressure is one of the most important tests for these patients. If you're not getting opening pressure, I think you're kind of missing out on an important piece of information. If you're not routinely performing opening pressures, you're going to miss patients with pseudotumor cerebri, AKA idiopathic intracranial hypertension. You're gonna miss the cryptococcal meningitis patient who are notorious for not growing back CSF fungus. So please just do the opening pressure. So we placed this patient in lateral recumbent. Him being intubated made this whole situation much, much easier. If you have a patient with difficult body habitus, ultrasound can aid your detection of finding an intraspinous space and finding the depth of the actual ligaments and knowing whether your needle is going to reach before sticking it in the patient's back. Our gentleman was nice and thin. We didn't have to bother with that. We anesthetized. We performed the LP. Just as a brief aside, if you want to prevent postdural headache, the way you do it is by proper bevel alignment in a way that's not going to cut the fibers and therefore cause a persistent CSF leak. You got to use a very small needle, 22 gauge preferably or smaller, and you need operator skill. Those probably are the only three factors that really affect the postdural headache. All that crap about lying flat on your back or caffeine or fluids, none of that stuff has been shown to work. It's just perform the LP properly. You could also get special needles that are atraumatic. If you have them, use them. most of the time, EDs don't have these, anesthesia does. All right, so we perform our LP and the opening pressure on this gentleman is 32 centimeters of water, which is quite high. Normal is less than 20 centimeters of water. The fluid was cloudy. Point our suspicions were already, in my mind, confirmed this guy had meningitis. Because our pretest probability was high, he was already fully treated. We sent the standard stuff, which obviously is cell count, protein, glucose, Gram stain, and cultures. Our patient was non-immunocompromised, so we didn't have to send all the other things like fungal cultures, acid fast bacilli culture, India ink preps. One additional thing we did send on this gentleman because he was altered was a PCR for herpes in the CSF. That test takes a while to come back, but it's better than any viral cultures they're going to grow. In addition, we sent a CSF lactate. Most people aren't doing this. This is a pretty good test for finding out if you have bacterial meningitis. If the lactate is greater than 6, that should be very scary for bacterial meningitis. If it's less than 2, pretty unlikely. I'll put those papers in the show notes. The way you do it is you drop a sterile ABG syringe onto your field, and you just attach that to the end of the needle, let it fill up, cap it, put it on ice, and you send it to your lab to get analyzed in their blood gas machine as a body fluid lactate. Now, how are you going to interpret your results? Well, obviously, glucose low when compared to the serum is bad for having bacteria up there. Protein high could be viral, it could be bacterial. Most of the time, the protein will be high. Most important one, obviously, is your cell count. And all that matters is cell count in tube 4. By that time, hopefully, any traumatic tap will have cleared, and that's really where the money is. So if your white cells are less than 100, that sharply reduces but does not eliminate the possibility of bacterial meningitis. And oftentimes, bacterial meningitis will have CSF white counts greater than 100, usually greater than 1,000, but that is not necessarily so. So don't avoid diagnosing bacterial meningitis because you have a CSF white count of 110. Now, the red cells could be due to something like herpes encephalitis, or they could be due to traumatic tap. And there are ways of trying to calculate out a traumatic tap from a true representation of red cells in the CSF. So for every one white cell, you're supposed to have 750 reds. So if you take your reds and you divide it by 750, that should be how much whites are being affected. I find this whole thing to be kind of crappy. What I do is simple, and I do the same thing for my subarachnoid. I ignore tube 1 because it doesn't matter. I will send the cell count on that because the team wants to see it, but I ignore it. And I will put a ton of CSF in tube 3. Tube 3 is my culture tube, and I'm doing this for two reasons. First of all, they need a lot of extra CSF to run all the extra tests that might be needed in the patient's future when you find more things out. And more importantly, you're clearing the way for tube 4. Tube 4 is the magic tube. You want a ton of CSF. You know, I usually put 4 to 5 cc's in tube 3 before I put tube 4 up there, so that tube 4 is as close to realistic as possible, and that eliminates the traumatic tap nature for both subarachnoid and meningitis. And so I'll look at my cell count in tube 4. Don't get fooled by that whole lymphocyte versus seg cell stuff. You can have bacterial meningitis with a lymphocytic predominance. I say ignore all this. Look, if my white count is high, they're coming in for meningitis. And I do not play those viral meningitis games where I'm sending the patient home unless everything else is pristine. I mean, maybe if the patient has a WPC count of 14 and they look perfect, and even then, I really worry about it. I don't generally discharge patients with positive CSF. You know, I've done it sometimes in the past, but generally you're coming in if you have any significant white cell count in your CSF. All right, let's talk about the steroid controversy. A lot of papers on this, back and forth. I gotta tell you, I don't think the evidence is too clear. I don't have much problem giving steroids. I will not give them to the low pretest probability patient before their TAP. Even though there was one paper that said steroids must precede antibiotics, there's been others that say that's not true, just get them in as soon as possible. So that's the way I play it. So in my low or moderate pretest probability patient, to whom I'm just giving ceftriaxone, I don't give the steroids until their CSF comes back positive by cell count. In my high pretest probability patients, like the gentleman we're discussing, I gave the steroids with the whole bevy of antibiotics and antivirals. Honestly, I don't know if this works. All right, next, let's talk about good supportive care. Meningitis and meningoencephalitis are a source for possible severe sepsis and septic shock. These patients can be incredibly sick. So you check your lactate in the serum as well, screen them for poor tissue perfusion. You maintain fluid resuscitation. If these patients do wind up having Neisseria, they are at risk for losing fingers and toes. And a lot of that is due to poor perfusion to these distal portions of the extremities. Part of that infection, Neisseria infection, is a loss of perfusion to these small vessels. So you want to do everything possible to maintain perfusion. So treat them just like a bad septic patient. Isolation. Until you prove it is not Neisseria, the patients need droplet precautions. Not airborne, droplet, which means if they're in your ED and there's more than 6 feet around them, they don't need to be in a negative pressure room. When you go up to the bedside, you need basically a surgical mask. You might as well wear the N95s. It can't hurt, but they're unnecessary. Now, what about exposure prophylaxis for the staff? Technically, you're supposed to have intimate contact with these patients, or you're sticking your nose in their mouth while you're intubating to really need post-exposure prophylaxis. That being said, if you were somewhere in the same building, generally we're handing out the ciprofloxacin because people just will not accept those true risk stratifications. If you had contact with a patient, generally you're going to wind up getting post-exposure prophylaxis. If you want to refuse it because you didn't go anywhere near the patient, I think that's just fine. And we just let our infection control people go wild with this. We generally are not calling up the patient's family. We let them handle it. You have some time. It doesn't need to be an immediate provision of these medications. And our infection control place, people will track down the paramedics, and you know, it's a whole nightmare. And you just hope that you get a gram stain with some gram positive chains so that you know it's not Neisseria. If you get gram stain and it comes back gram negative diplococci, well, now you know you better go down an exposure pathway. Next question that comes up is ICP monitoring. That opening pressure at 32 centimeters water indicates a elevated ICP. And I have had patients whose opening pressures are 50, 60. These patients have increased intracranial pressure. Now, do they need intracranial monitoring or treatment? And the answer is no one knows. And I think it's an institution-dependent thing. University of Maryland, where their neurosurgery service was generally placing Camino parenchymal monitors on these patients, getting ICP and treating them. The hospital I'm at now, not so much. They don't really believe there's any proof that this benefits the patients in meningitis. And I agree with them. There is no proof. So go with your institution. I think it is a little scary that if there's so much swelling there to generate a ICP greater than 50, to not do anything about it seems to be intuitively a poor idea, but I can't prove that to you. What I do think is a good idea in these cases is if you did have a very high opening pressure, you either speak to your neurologist or your ICU or medicine team, depending on who's going to be taking care of the patient, and you advocate for a repeat tap in 24 to 48 hours, and this will do two things. It'll allow them to make sure the CSF has been sterilized, and with good antibiotic regimen, it should be sterile at this point. And it will allow them to reassess the opening pressure, reassess the patient's pressure, drain off a little more CSF. All right, cutting edge stuff. There are a host of new tests you could send to get more rapid bacterial identification. Things like agglutination studies that actually look for the bugs, PCR studies for things other than herpes. I don't have access to these. I don't have experience with these. If anyone does, by all means, write in. or put comments in the show notes. Tell us how these have worked out for you. All right, I think I'm getting to the time maximum here. I'm going to sign off. Let me know what you think. If you haven't already and you have a second, please go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. That keeps us in the rankings. If you want to leave a comment, please do that as well. If you have anything you'd like to see changed or you have any comments about this episode, send me an email or drop it in the show notes. It's been a pleasure talking to you this week. Bye-bye.